This Janet Mett for Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us again. I hope nobody takes this the wrong way. And I think I can probably get away with saying this because you understand where I'm coming from when I say this. But I'm getting really tired of the woman card. I just am. I'm getting really tired of the woman card. How many years have we been deluged with, there's no difference between the sexes. There should be equality. We're all the same. Women should be able to do exactly what men do. Women should be able to serve in all the same ways men do. Women should have the same access to power that men do. We should have the first woman president, and it needs to be Hillary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Women and men are equal. This is what we have had shoved down our throats for how many years? And all of a sudden, all these same liberal feminists who have been shoving this stuff down our throats all of these years have turned into a bunch of delicate pearl clutchers. Why? Why is there this transformation? And it isn't just the women, by the way. It's the men as well. It's the liberal men who are now using the case of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to constantly go after men as if every man who is especially a white man is somehow guilty of sexual abuse of some kind. This is out of control. We have not only the presumption of innocence in this country, but we ought to have logical, reasonable minds to some extent in order to have a civil society. You can't just go around casting blame on somebody with no corroborating evidence. This is the whole thing. I'm going to get into more on this. First, I want to go to what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had to say yesterday, which I thought was great. Listen to cut one.
Shortly after Dr. Ford's confidential letter made its way into the press, the floodgates of mud and muck opened entirely on Brett Kavanaugh and his family. Out of the woodwork came one uncorroborated allegation after another, each seemingly more outlandish than the last. A tabloid lawyer organized a red carpet rollout for someone who wanted to accuse Judge Kavanaugh of masterminding some kind of high school drug and serial sexual assault ring, hosting one wild party after another filled with sexual violence for which there conveniently happened to be zero witnesses. Zero witnesses. But plenty of people to refute the claims. This didn't say in the tabloids, by the way. This fantastic story was effectively read into the record of the Judiciary Committee by the ranking member, who decided it deserved a mention in her remarks during last Thursday's hearing. And every Democratic member of the Judiciary Committee seized on this outlandish tale in a formal letter in which they called on Judge Kavanaugh to withdraw his name from consideration. This is how desperate some became for any way to stop this stunningly qualified nominee. I guess upholding any standards of any kind was just too much to ask.
Well, this is exactly what the left does. It is too much to ask. They said from the very outset that they would never, ever, ever let Judge Kavanaugh be confirmed if they could get away with stopping it. And so they're pulling out all the stops. So you have the New York Times coming up with this big expose of Brett Kavanaugh having, back in 1985, perhaps thrown ice. This is some kind of bombshell report. I mean, are you kidding me? And then you had Julie Swetnick, one of the accusers, go on NBC, and NBC said, we can't independently confirm her story. And oh, by the way, things she said to us on camera are actually at odds with what she put in her written statement last week. Why are you interviewing her again? Then she talks about, oh, wait a minute. I know that I said Judge Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge had spiked the punch at this party eons ago, and then women were attacked. But now, I don't really know if they spiked the punch, but I'll tell you what, Judge Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh back then, was handing out solo cups. Last I checked, handing out solo cups was not something to derail a Supreme Court nominee over, was it? I mean, this is what's getting airtime. We had this terrible cartoon that was printed in which a little girl who is presumably Judge Kavanaugh's daughter, whom he very touchingly revealed last week had been praying for Christine Ford, was portrayed in this cartoon as saying, "Oh, Lord, I also want to pray for my angry father who sexually assaulted Christine Ford." I mean, this, how is that even funny, cute, appealing in any way? It is the politics of personal destruction. Yes, let's bring that Clinton phrase back into the vernacular. Let's go on with McConnell. Listen to cut two.
We heard another anonymous, unattributed, and now thoroughly debunked account. This time, an anonymous accusation from Colorado alleging physical abuse 20 years ago. A sitting federal district judge quickly stepped up to bat down that anonymous smear. We heard that Judge Kavanaugh was supposedly responsible for a sexual assault on a boat in Newport, Rhode Island, until the accuser recanted the story completely, but not before many in the media had begun eating it up. In short, Democrats' mishandling of Dr. Ford's letter opened the floodgates for this deluge of uncorroborated, unbelievable mud. And the mudslide was cheered on and capitalized on at every turn by the far left that has been so eager to stop this nomination.
Well, right. And I mean, among those people has been Cory Booker, who himself had written about groping a young girl when he was younger. These people are hypocrites, but it doesn't matter because they're on the right side of the political aisle. So just like Bill Clinton has all sorts of women coming forward and accusing him credibly of all sorts of things and actually do have corroboration in some of these accusations. Paula Jones brought a lawsuit against former President Clinton. Remember when he perjured himself and got himself impeached? Remember all that? Doesn't matter. He's pro-abortion, and Brett Kavanaugh, so they think, is pro-life. And because of that, he's got to go. That's what it is. Then what about the New York Times story? This is what Mitch McConnell had to say on that. This is cut three.
The New York Times unleashed this major story. Get this. Judge Kavanaugh may have been accused of throwing some ice across a college bar in the mid-1980s. Talk about a bombshell. One can only imagine what new bombshell might be published today or tomorrow. But here's what we know, Madam President. One thing for sure. The Senate will vote on Judge Kavanaugh here on this floor this week. Here on this floor this week. Our Democratic friends will try to move the goalpost yet again. Just yesterday, they submitted a list of 24 people whom they wanted the FBI to interview. So I'm confident we'll hear that even the very same supplemental FBI investigation Democrats had so loudly demanded is now magically no longer sufficient. Well, after the FBI shares what they've found, senators will have the opportunity to vote. We'll have the opportunity to vote no on the politics of personal destruction. We'll have the opportunity to vote yes on this fine nominee.
All right. Well, I hope it turns out in Judge Kavanaugh's favor because he has been through so much and there's just nothing there. We'll see, because the FBI report, the investigation is supposed to be concluded as early as today. And whether or not we'll be able to get a full synopsis on it is up in the air, because the Senate Majority Leader said that the report is expected soon and will be made available to each senator, and only senators will be allowed to look at it. Senator Cornyn of Texas said, well, we need to put out some sort of public statement because of the high interest in this. People will want to know what the FBI's investigation concluded. So we'll see how it all comes down. But the fact that this has been allowed to go forward in the name of women drives me crazy. I care very, very much about women who really have been sexually abused and really have suffered molestation or assault of some sort. It is a gut-wrenching crime that occurs against women that never should occur. But when you have this kind of stuff, it cheapens the real stories. When I hear Christine Ford saying what really is indelible in her brain is the laughter of Kavanaugh and Judge, shouldn't it be the attempted rape that you claim happened that's indelible in your mind? It just this kind of stuff makes me crazy. She doesn't know how she got to the house. She doesn't know how she left. She doesn't know when it was. She doesn't know where it was. But boy, you can believe her when she tells you what happened during the assault, which isn't the indelible part. It just doesn't make any sense at all. We're going to come back. I'm going to explain more what I'm talking about with this woman card. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Imagine what it would be like if America were decimated by a civil war and millions of us had to flee for our lives. Imagine living in a crowded tent city with very little to eat, no education for your kids, and the threat of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking all around you. Well, that's been the situation in Lebanon for several years now. In fact, 2 million of these refugees are living in tent cities in Lebanon, but there, they're finding the hope of Jesus Christ. That's been the situation because of our wonderful ministry partner, Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is there among the refugees right now, offering the gospel of Jesus Christ, food to eat, and a Christian education for the many, many children who are in great need. At Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, little children like John are learning to read, getting nutritious meals, and hearing the good news that Jesus is his Savior. Not only are these children coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. And when they go back home, they'll be taking the gospel with them to parts of the Middle East that many of us could never reach. Your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 of these refugee children, while a gift of $98 will feed and educate an entire classroom full of children. That's 18 children for 1 entire day. We really need your help right now. So we're asking, call right now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Let's help create the next great Christian missionary force. The Lord is working in the hearts of refugee children in Lebanon, but we need your financial help. 866-485-9187. Again, your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 refugee children. Please call now, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Thanks for being here. We'll see what happens if the FBI investigation, which may conclude as early as today, is wrapped up and the Senate moves forward with voting on Judge Brett Kavanaugh. This has been the most insane thing I think I've seen in the political world in my whole life. And I didn't think anything was going to get more crazy than the Clarence Thomas hearings. But leave it to the Democrats to make it even more insane. So let's talk a little bit about this woman card thing, which I've brought up. I'm getting really tired of the whole women are to be believed, believe women. No, it should be believe women if they're telling the truth and can corroborate their evidence and file police reports to that effect. And they look into it and they discover that she was telling the truth. Then you should believe women. And I'm not saying there's never been a case in which a woman has made a true accusation and it was properly prosecuted. We know the courts are not perfect either. But you don't say believe women when they have no corroborating evidence. What you do in that case is you throw the case out. And this is exactly what Rachel Mitchell had to say, the legal counsel brought in by the Republicans during the committee hearing, who said, there's nothing here. There's nothing here in terms of a case. So this is an important point that's being lost, and you can leave it to liberal men who are playing the woman card to obscure this fact. Let's go to CNN host Jake Tapper. He was on with Stephen Colbert on his show recently and was talking about women and how men need to be quiet. It's the same sort of thing that Senator Mazie Hirono said about men just need to shut up. It's ridiculous. Listen to this exchange. This is Cut 6.
On State of the Union this past Sunday, yeah. it was Jake Tapper and then an all-female panel of guests, including Kellyanne Conway and Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then a panel of four women guests as well.
Do you think that this story is going to change how reporters cover not just accusations of sexual assault, but the role of women in Washington politics, that it's going to change the sort of the primacy or the importance of women's voices?
Well, I hope so. I think that I've had all women panels lots of times. But it is true that this Sunday I felt that we'd heard from men enough. And
Yeah, we've heard from men enough, which is why Jake Tapper is running the show and Stephen Colbert is interviewing him about it, because we've heard from men enough. The only men that liberal women will tolerate is men who will capitulate and pander to liberal women. And let's make sure that we put that qualifier in front of the word women, liberal women, because they're certainly not putting together many panels with conservative women who will say the same thing that I'm saying now, which is, absent any corroborating evidence, you are railroading this whole situation against a man who says he's innocent and so far has not had to face any evidence that would prove him wrong. What about that? Well, it's all about going after the man as if all men are terrible and all men are guilty. Now, this is really unbelievable. You might have heard that Donald Trump Jr. had done an interview and said that he's worried now about his sons because, and I've heard a lot of people say this, by the way, in the wake of the Kavanaugh accusations, you do have to worry. Telling your boys, make sure you're never in a compromising position where somebody might be able to falsely accuse you of something. You know, behave yourself. Parents ought to be saying that anyway. Jeffrey Toobin, the legal analyst over at CNN, had this to say. Listen to Cut 5.
Every night, I cry myself to sleep over the fate of white men in America. White men have no power. White men, I mean, it's such garbage.
And
I mean,
you're
it is
not
so
listening
ridiculous.
To right-wing media where well, this is a talking point that has gone on like wild.
I understand that. And you know what? If you sexually assault someone in high school, your life should be ruined. Your life should be pursued. I mean, the idea that this is somehow unjust. Remember, this all started with accusations of sexual assault. How about the lives of the women who were sexually assaulted in high school? How about the 15-year-old Ms. Blasey? She wasn't Ms. Blasey Ford in those days. How about her life? All this whining about the poor plight of white men is ridiculous.
Wow. Spoken like a white man. Are you kidding me? You're a legal analyst. Should you not be first concerned with whether or not Brett Kavanaugh is guilty or innocent? This isn't somebody who's just had a conviction handed down, by the way. And second of all, when he says that if you sexually assaulted somebody in high school, your life should be ruined. Really? Is that why we have separate legal penalties for underage criminals? Because we recognize as a society that when you are younger than 18, you might not have the same judgment that you would have or responsibility that you would have as an adult and shouldn't be punished as an adult. Is that why we have records for juvenile delinquents wiped clean under certain circumstances if they're able to serve their time or do their duty to make sure that they make up for the crime? I mean, are you kidding me? This guy's a legal analyst. I'm not a lawyer, and I know that. Your life should not be ruined if you sexually assault somebody. If you sexually assaulted somebody, you should have the chance to defend yourself in court and not have to go before the whole country and let leftists throw smears at you with women who are not necessarily telling the truth. And in fact, we've already had accusers of Brett Kavanaugh who have withdrawn and recanted their stories and not been able to prove them or change their stories, or they have selective memories. What about his innocence? And what does being a white man have to do with it anyway? What does that have to do with anything? I'm so over it, and I'm tired of the woman card, and I'm tired of the whole idea that women are all on the same side and we're all against men and we're all victims, and give me a break. Enough is enough on that stuff. And I want to go to the Word of God on this, because this is an obvious analogy that we have in Joseph, in Genesis chapter 39. Do you remember what happened to Joseph? He was taken down to Egypt, and this Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, Potiphar, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there, and the Lord was with Joseph. So he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, and he found favor in his sight. He became his personal servant, and he made him overseer in his house and over everything that he owned. And the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. And so he left everything Potiphar did in Joseph's charge, and then he left. And what happened? Well, Joseph was handsome. And it came about after these events that Potiphar's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me," but he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he didn't listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. So she's trying to make a play for him. And one day he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there. She caught him by his garment. She said, "Lie with me," and left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. And when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." Oh, wait a minute. Believe women, right? Believe women. All women are completely honest about Me Too. Every single woman who's ever told a Me Too story is telling the truth by virtue of being a woman. Not true. So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." False accusation against an innocent man. I hope Judge Kavanaugh is reading Genesis 39 and what happened. He went to prison. He went to prison. His master heard the words and said, you know, his anger burned. And so he put him in jail. He put him in jail. But what does verse 21 say? "But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper." And what ended up happening at the end of the book of Genesis? You remember the story. What happened? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That was the end of the Joseph story. And why is the life of Joseph so important here? Well, this particular story is very important here for a couple of reasons. Not only to prove that every single person on planet Earth is a sinner who is capable of lying, male and female, but also to point out that the Lord upheld Joseph. He upheld Joseph through all of the lying, through all of the false accusations, through all of the hatred that he endured from his brothers and being sold into slavery, the whole life that he endured before he ended up being exonerated and forgiving. And it's a very powerful story that applies to us today. Even when you look at 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 16, it talks about having a good conscience so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. This is what the Christian is to do. Live such a good life of honor unto the Lord Jesus that even if people lie about you and even if people tell false stories about you or falsely accuse you, and there are many of us who have had that situation happen to us. Lots and lots of people have had that happen in small ways and big ways. Just remember, the Lord is capable and is quick to take care of his own, even in that kind of a situation. And what else is important? Forgiveness. This may be the hardest thing of all, but those who are falsely accused must forgive. Why? Because God in Christ forgave us. So it's a lesson on a lot of fronts. It's a lesson about dealing with false accusations. It's a lesson about playing the woman card, not being a biblical concept, because women can lie, or women can be confused, or women can be paid off. It just depends on the woman, or a woman can be telling the truth, but you've really got to look at the evidence. And we'll see how this all pans out with Judge Kavanaugh. But in the end, what I'm hoping happens is that Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed, as President Trump has assured us he will be confirmed, and that he will be able to forgive those who have so deeply wronged him. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford Today after this. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Meffer Today. What is a public school teacher to do when the students he's trying to teach are out of control? And what is that teacher to do when standard methods of dealing with problem students either aren't working or he isn't allowed to fully employ those methods? Well, my next guest offers an insider's perspective on the problem and proposes a solution as well. Cinque Henderson is a former teacher. He's current writer for Showtime's The Shy. And the name of his latest book is Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. Cinque, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Hey, I couldn't be more delighted. Thank you guys for bringing me on.
Well, it's good to talk to you about this. I find this really interesting because you have been a substitute teacher, I know, in some of the toughest schools in America. How did your time as a sub come about? Here you are in film and TV writing, and you're also a substitute teacher. You don't often hear about that.
Well, good question. I'm kind of a... As a writer, that's what pays my bills for the most part. But as a writer, I'm a bit of a bum in the sense of if it were up to me, I'd be in bed at 4 a.m. And that ends up kind of throwing off my day. And so a friend of mine who had a charter school, was a principal at a charter school, said, look, you should sub a couple days a week. Both of my parents were educators. And I'd always been involved, whether it be tutoring, even in college, and I always liked it. So I said, why don't I do that? It'll give me a way to organize my day, organize my week. And so I did it. I sort of signed up, went to the school, had both a wonderful time, but also a crazy, outrageous time. Sort of the opening anecdote is about this experience. Really, I think it was either my first or second period on my first day where this kid, you know, called me, as they say in the South, called me everything but a child of God.
Wow.
And then the crazy part is they put him out of my class. I put him out. I got the campus. They sent him out. And then 5 to 10 minutes later, they sent him back into my class saying, okay to return to class. There was no detention. There was no suspension. There was no calling home. I asked. No sort of reconciliation process. And I thought, whoa, what's this?
Yeah.
And so from there, kind of that was sort of the opening thing that sparked really a question. Anytime you write a book, you're really kind of answering a question.
Right.
And so that was kind of the very beginning. And it took me on kind of a crazy journey just trying to understand the public education system, trying to understand issues both mainly a kind of class, but also there's some racial issues as well. I tend to the liberal side of things, but there are certain universal issues, certain universal truths, I think, that one of which is kids got to behave.
Yes, that's
right. No matter what school they're in, what kind of parochial school, public school, private school. And so that's the substituting came in that way. And I found that it was terrific because one day I'd be in a poor public school in East L.A., then the next day I'd be in a rich private school in West L.A., then I'd be in a Jewish Orthodox conservative school, then a Jewish Orthodox, then a Jewish more liberal environment, and you really got a chance to look into a lot of different environments and see how things were working and what wasn't working and that kind of thing.
Right. Well, that would maybe send me right out of the classroom if I had a student do that to me and just kind of call me names and go off on me. How often did that sort of thing occur during your time as a sub?
Well, you know, I'm a pretty tough guy. Once the students kind of got used to me, it stopped happening.
That's good.
Because I don't play a lot of games, as they say.
That's good.
And before I go, I do want to make a point. I'm an African-American black guy. I do want to say that even though my experience was in poor black and poor Latin schools, this is actually a serious kind of universal problem.
Yeah.
It's not even necessarily tied. There is a component of what that has to do with poverty and that kind of thing. But the poor rural schools in white in the along the Appalachian Trail and the Midwest are dealing with this kind of thing. But even some of the upper middle class schools, just this freedom that the, and the word isn't even freedom, just this license that the young kids or young students feel that they have in relationship to adults.
Yes.
And it's everywhere. It's different versions in really rich schools, really sort of rich upper class schools, but there is a version of it. A friend of mine who teaches in Seattle, she literally sent me a text yesterday, said a kid walked into this class. He was having his, doing his planning period. He's a white guy. This student was white. She walked into his class. He said, you got to go back to your class. He says, I'm not going anywhere. And then she sat down and just started calling her boyfriend in his class, and he couldn't get her to leave.
Oh, man.
So it's universal there. It gets worse where there is poverty. And I can tell you one of the opening stories, and there's another aspect to it. As again, I say, my book is primarily about sort of black and Latin inner city schools, but this was a fascinating thing that I think related to what's going on in the Midwest today. I was driving home. I was talking to a teacher at this particular school that I took on a long-term assignment with, and he had gone to that school as a student. And he said, you know, the school was always tough. The kids used to fight each other. Now they fight the teacher.
Yeah.
That stunned me, right?
Yeah.
And right. I was like, what the heck happened? You know, how did we get here? Because we fought all the cats and dogs all the time when we were young, but we never cursed at a teacher.
No way.
Never fought a teacher.
No way.
So there are a couple of things. One that was very dramatic. So I was driving home one day, and Jay-Z, husband of Beyonce, he said, it was on, I think, NPR, and the interviewer asked him, what was the impact of crack cocaine coming into your neighborhood? And he had sold crack, as everyone knows, when he was young. And he said the most fascinating thing to me that I'd ever heard. He said it destroyed the authority figure.
Really?
Now, I was like, what the heck is he talking about? And so I listened more, and then I started to do research. Because of the mandatory drug sentences that were given to drug dealers, which we all kind of cheer for on some level fundamentally, they shifted the dealing of crack cocaine to kids. They gave it to young kids because if you were an adult, you would go to jail for 10 years.
Right.
If you were a kid, you go for 3 months and then be back out on the streets. And so crack cocaine was really a child economy. And there are economists who said you cannot underestimate the impact of crack cocaine on poor inner city neighborhoods. It swept through those neighborhoods like the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Oh, it's awful.
And the kids were the ones making the money. And because crack was so addictive, the adults were the ones debasing themselves for the crack cocaine. And so in the first chapter, I say, look, this is something that we have to look out now for the opioid crisis.
Yes.
We have to look at that and the impact it's having as much as we want to look at those doctors and those pharmaceutical companies for what they're doing, putting that poison into the street. We got to make sure we're responding to that in the best way because there are always bad consequences.
Wow. I never knew that. That raises the stakes right there when you learn about the child economy and crack cocaine. And obviously, I mean, I'm white, so that's not a world I run in necessarily, but that's an important education for all of us to know that's going on.
Absolutely. And I grew up in the South. I grew up in a pretty much poor black town, a middle working class black town in the South. So crack cocaine never really touched us. But the fallout from it worldwide, it was such an aggressive incursion into poor inner city communities. And it completely upended the way young people saw adults. So I wasn't teaching the kids who were dealing 20 years ago, but I'm teaching their kids.
Yes, right.
You know what I'm saying? So they grew up with the same resentment, because crack took over the same way the opioids are taking over those white, poor inner cities and towns in the Midwest. Crack cocaine wiped through those. And it was joblessness and drug addiction. Just that compound effect was devastating.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We have to look back, and as a people, whatever side of the aisle you're on, we're obviously in a time where there's a lot of fighting between different sides of the aisle. There's certain things that I think the opioid crisis, which is affecting primarily poor whites, crack cocaine primarily affected poor blacks and poor Latins, is something for us to learn from these shared difficult experiences.
For sure, for sure. And, really important
and,
point.
Yeah, and that's one thing I hope the book is a tough book. It really is an honest book, but it's also, I think, a hopeful book in the sense of I do try to suggest here are ways we can deal with this, and both with compassion, but also we need stringency too. We need discipline as well.
Very, very true. We're going to come back and talk about that. Cinque Henderson with us. His book is Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. We'll come back. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in our lifetime. 2 million refugees are in the tiny country of Lebanon, and most of these are kids with only a surviving mother living in disease-ridden tent settlements. They are the innocent victims of war. But you can help. Call 866-485-9187. Your gift of $98 will help rescue 18 of these children and bring them to the Heart for Lebanon Hope Centers, where they can learn, be fed, and most importantly, begin a relationship with Jesus Christ. Rescue a classroom for Christ before someone else captures them for evil. Call 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Our goal is to take care of 61 classroom days. Will you please help me sponsor 1, 2, or even 5 classrooms right now? Call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. I'm Janet Mefford today. Glad you're here and glad to be talking with Cinque Henderson, a former teacher, substitute teacher. He's talking a little bit about his experience in some of America's toughest schools in his book, Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. You were laying out for us, Cinque, before we went to the break, the fact that you have the drug problem, the crack cocaine, the child economy, and that how that informs the situation in a lot of these tougher, maybe, you know, urban environments that you've been in and that you've taught in. But as you mentioned before, you have a problem with erasure of the line between adult and child all over this country. And I've seen this too. All kids, I mean, I've seen this to some extent where they just don't respect adults for being adults. And people talk about things also like the impact of TV, where you see the bumbling father on the sitcoms or the breakdown of the family. How do you think those things play into this lack of discipline that you're seeing when you're standing in front of a classroom full of students?
It's absolutely a part of it. And again, as I said, I'm African American, I'm black. I grew up in a working class environment where there was complete respect for authority. You know, white students, black students, it doesn't matter. One of the things that happened that I realized was, and generally speaking, as I said earlier, I tend to the liberal side of things, but some of these are universal truths. One of the things I realized that happened was I remember going into one school. It was a school not far from me in Los Angeles. And these kids, they were just going crazy. And like any other teacher, like, I'm going to hold you in for recess if you don't get it together. And they looked at me and they said, you can't do that. We have a right to play.
What?
And so I was like, what the heck are they talking about? So I tried to hold them in. And then later on, the administrator came and said, yeah, we don't do that. Our kids have a right to play. I didn't know what they were talking about. Well, in 1989, the United Nations passed something called the Declaration of the Rights of the Child.
Yes.
And there are many that are terrific. A child has a right to a name. That's a beautiful thing. They have a right to be safe from child aggressive child labor and to be conscripted in the war, you know, all just the right to education, all things, no matter who you are, you would accept and agree. Mm-hmm. But they also they also said kids have a right to freedom of speech. Who has a right to free? What child has a right to freedom of speech? Then they said a kid has a right to practice their own religion or no religion. I remember thinking, my dad was a preacher. If I was about woke up at nine saying I'm not going to work because I'm not, he would have, that wouldn't have happened. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, but then they said a child has a right to play. And I remember thinking, oh, that's where they got it from. And so, and don't mind you, I get the sentiment behind it. Of course, it's in the nature of all young mammals, frankly, to want to play.
Sure.
But you don't have a right to play over that superior to your right and obligation to be respectful to an adult.
Yes.
And you certainly don't have a right to play that can neutralize an adult's right to pull you back in the line. And so universally, this is a thing going on, again, no matter the class, no matter the race, no matter the income level. And I think you're right with some of the cultural things. You know, we do in this economy, we do play to what kids like and what kids want. You know, advertisers, what do the 13 to 19-year-olds want? What do the, you know, 18 to 35-year-olds want? This is in the same way that crack cocaine was in the inner cities. This is a kind of a child economy. Mm-hmm. It's driven by what do the, you know, that's what advertisers want. That's the coveted market. And you know, kids aren't the ones that should be driving our society.
Exactly. Exactly. Because we're charged as adults with making sure that they turn into responsible adults, not making sure they're all Veruca Salt and they get everything they want now. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. And I agree with you that discipline is so important. The question is, how do you make that happen in the classroom when there are so many challenges, not just with the kids being disrespectful, but sometimes even with the administration in a school that says, well, you can't really clamp down on the kid. I mean, how do you advise teachers to deal with that? Teachers in the public school who can relate to what you're talking about?
Well, you know, there really is, I try to go as deep and as possible as I can with the book to talk about just both policy wise and sort of individually. It's both broad and some sort of specific things. There's one aspect. So, for example, fatherlessness, boys who grow without fathers, they tend to be a little more erratic in their behavior. That's just a given.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have, I think, say black neighborhoods, for example, only 2% of the public school teachers are black men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe 20% are men, period. And I know a lot of people don't like, oh, gender doesn't matter. It does matter sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and men, the presence of men in public schools can be helpful in just, what, look, we're half the population. So, you know, that is helpful. Trying to recruit more men, I think, into, and more than just the coach, although that's abundantly helpful, and I think can be beneficial as a general rule. I don't think there's any environment that should have, you know, only 10% women or only 10% men. You know, every environment needs some sort of that gender parity. Not 100%, but you understand.
Oh, I do. I do. Especially, I think you were saying in the book at one point, you know, it's hard for a mom if you just have a mom at home to wrestle a gun from you or, you know, overpower you if you're a big teenager.
This is what I realized. This was a fascinating revelation that I had. I was watching these middle school students. And one was saying, oh, I'm worried about seeing my dad this weekend because he punches me when he's mad. And another one said, yeah, me too. I knew that they were actually bragging. If you don't know how boys talk, middle school boys, I knew they were bragging about the strength of their fathers, right? So then I was on Twitter, and this older black, these are black guys, but it doesn't matter. I'm just having what the race is. They were saying, fellas, what age were you when you challenged the authority figure, the male authority figure in your life? And it was hysterical responses from these guys who were like, I was 13, I was taller than my dad, and so I kind of said something reckless. My dad punched me in my chest and knocked me on the floor. Still my best friend. So it was just these series of responses. And I realized that what was going on was, when boys hit puberty, and they're suddenly bigger than their mom, stronger than their mom, faster than their mom, and again, this doesn't have anything to do with race, and they realize somewhere in the back of their mind that they could actually hurt their mom, in fact, to be even more direct, even kill their mom if they really set their mind to it, they think subconsciously that they're an adult.
Yeah.
They think subconsciously that they're a man. That's just that's just the nature of gender. And I'm here for gender equality. I'm here for sex. You know, I want people to be who they are. But a mom cannot, at a certain age, cannot overpower her son.
No.
But if you have a dad and you talk to him recklessly and say something and he knocks you in your chest or picks you up off your feet, you realize, oh, I'm not an adult yet.
Exactly.
I'm still a kid.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
That's important to tamp down the hormonal surge of his belief in his own maturity.
That's a great insight. It's true. And I mean, this points out the difference between mom and dad. I've lived that. I have a 6'3 son who's 17 years old, and I can attest to that. He's bigger
Absolutely.
Than I am. Yep.
Absolutely. And so it dawned on me why, you know, I was actually talking to this really great psychiatrist named Steven Pinker, and he is the one, he just randomly said, oh, there's this study that boys who grow up without fathers in neighborhoods where there are fathers turn out okay. So it made me think, well, what's it like for a boy who grows up without a father in a neighborhood where other boys don't have fathers? And that's very prevalent in poor communities, white and black. And it dawned on me, oh, this mechanism, the psychological mechanism for boys, they need someone, whether it's a dad or a father figure, to say, watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the boundaries.
They need those boundaries. And it's and so, again, one of the prescriptions in the book is more male figures in their lives in these schools. I saw it as a guy in these schools, like these boys will respond to me in a way that they just would not respond to female teachers. It's just the truth.
It is the truth.
And it's the reverse with the girls. I taught in a middle school. Those girls gave me the flux, but they love their female teachers.
Funny.
You know, it's just, and you know, once you get older, it's a different thing. But in that period, when you're moving from fifth to sixth grade, into particularly in the middle school, when your hormones kick in, you turn into, there's a different type of relationship that you have to your own body, relationship psychology that comes in, relationship to adults, and you need that. And that's just one of the recommendations in the book, that we really need to make public schools a more welcome place for the male presence.
Yeah, exactly.
Without driving, you know, women have done remarkable things in public education. I was educated primarily by women. So I in no way, shape, or form want to downplay the importance. But men are equally important in the development of boys and girls.
Absolutely. No, I agree completely. I think you're right on the money about that. And I think there's a generation of kids who are coming along who desperately want those boundaries, and they want, because that's in large measure how they know that the adults in their lives care about them. And I think this is a really important book in that regard. It's called Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. Cynke Henderson with us. Cynke, it was great to have you here. Really, really appreciate your being with us.
Hey, this has been a treat. Thank you so much, and thank you to your audience. Let's go out and get that book, and let's get the conversation going about it.
Sounds great. Thanks again, Cynke. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, you too. God bless you. And we'll see you next time here on Janet Mefford Today. Our website, as always, janetmefford.com.